Which is better for CPR, someone's hands or a machine?
When you take antiplatelet agents after a stent is placed, how long should they be continued?
Yet one more danger of police work.
And it's HDL function, not HDL levels, that matter.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center, El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, you have already quipped that we're going to call this particular podcast Heavy on the Heart. That's because this week the American Heart Association meeting is taking place and all of our studies are featured there.
You're right. This is not lighthearted.
Oh, boo. Did you think of that before we started, or was that something that just came up?
Just came up. It's me.
It's amazing. Truly amazing. So this issue I'm going to start with is published in The Lancet. That's the idea that, gosh, is a machine or are people's hands better at performing CPR? This, of course, is an ongoing issue. How do we improve survival when this technique is employed?
And since we have over 420,000 cardiac arrests in the United States each year and about 275,000 cardiac arrests in Europe, this ends up being an issue that affects a significant number of individuals. And we know that the survival rate is already pretty low. 1 in 16 or 1 in 17 individuals typically survives with neurologic function intact. So can we improve that? As you know, the most important thing is to initiate CPR quickly and to do it effectively. And for people that may not be trained or people that may get tired doing it, there's a thought that you doing mechanical CPR could be beneficial. By the way, especially if you're doing it in an ambulance where it can be even more difficult to do CPR. So that's what this study addressed. They did a pre-hospital randomization of people that had sudden cardiac death. And before they arrived, they randomized them to either receiving manual CPR or receiving mechanical CPR with a compression device. So they had over 4,400 individuals that were eligible to receive either of those two therapies. And then they looked at the 30-day outcome. How likely were they to survive the hospital discharge and, more importantly, at 30 days? And even looked at the neurologic function. What they discovered was in the mechanical group, about 6% of individuals survived to 30 days, whereas in the manual CPR group, it was 7%. There was no statistically significant difference. And importantly, when they looked at neurologic function, it was actually a little bit worse in the mechanical group.
Well, yet one more thing it sounds like we need to advise EMTs about so that they can employ the appropriate technique when they're transporting someone to the hospital.
Absolutely. And part of the issue with mechanical devices, not only are they expensive, but they do require training and updating and continued follow-up and making sure they're used correctly. In fact, in this study, only 60% of the time when the individuals were randomized to receive a mechanical device, did they actually do it. So what this tells me is that we don't need costly mechanical devices, as you described. We need effective CPR delivered as quickly as possible.
And I have to say, I'm really glad that this study was done just because a priori, we probably all would have said, wow, a mechanical device is probably going to be more consistent and it may even be faster, whatever. So I'm really happy that this has been addressed in this way.
And by the way, this is the third study that's addressed this, and they've all found similar conclusions. And this one is a little bit different because it was pragmatic. It was like in the ambulance, and that's where you think mechanical CPR would shine the most. And in fact, it was no more effective than manual CPR.
Okay. So since we're talking about these emergent issues then, let's go to the BMJ. Study there taking a look at the hazards of police work, that sudden cardiac death.
I wasn't aware that the fatality among police officers is about 3 to 5 times the national average for private sector employees. There is a hypothesis that's been proven out in a number of different circumstances that the things that cause a heart attack are underlying risk factors, but then some immediate stress or stressor, if they're exercising, shoveling snow, or even firefighters have an increased risk. But nobody's really ever looked at this in police officers. So what they did is they looked at all sudden cardiac deaths based upon the National Law Enforcement Officers database and ascertained what percentage of the deaths are sudden cardiac deaths and do they occur at times of stress. And what they determined was of the officers who died, about 10% died of sudden cardiac death. And 3/4 of those occurred during emergency situations. Despite the fact that only about 1 or 2 or 3% of their time was spent in those circumstances, the vast majority of sudden cardiac deaths occurred during those circumstances. Sudden cardiac death was associated with restraining individuals, breaking up altercations, with physical training in 20% of the time, pursuing subjects in 12% of the time. So if you compare when they're doing routine non-emergency situations versus the emergency situations. During the latter, the risk of sudden cardiac death is 34 to 69 times higher.
That's impressive. Now, of course, we've done research here at Johns Hopkins taking a look at underlying conditions in firefighters that predict who's at risk for sudden cardiac death. So I would ask the same question then about the police officers.
Elizabeth, a great question. Unfortunately, they didn't have the data here to dig down into that.
So clearly begs the question of screening in these folks.
And it means we need to be very aggressive about managing their risk factors, like diabetes and high cholesterol and high blood pressure.
Excellent. Since you mentioned cholesterol then, let's move to the New England Journal of Medicine. Slicing and dicing the HDL picture. Wow, what number is really relevant?
Kudos to many of my colleagues at UT Southwestern that did this very interesting study looking not at HDL concentration, but actually its function. This is what we call the good cholesterol. And we know that elevated LDL cholesterol, so-called bad cholesterol, increases your risk of cardiovascular disease. And there's been a looser association of HDL cholesterol, the good cholesterol, and the risk of cardiovascular disease. The higher your HDL, allegedly, the lower your risk of cardiovascular disease. But when you begin to control for the other risk factors, obesity or the type of adiposity, HDL cholesterol loses a little bit of its predictive value. And they hypothesize that HDL does different things. The most important thing it does is it draws cholesterol from some of the cells inside the plaque. It transports it out and takes it to the liver to be excreted. This is called cholesterol transport. So they took, in their Dallas Heart Study, several thousand individuals who had no known heart disease. They measured their HDL cholesterol and all the other risk factors, and they measured the ability of HDL cholesterol to affect this reverse transportation. What they found is that the HDL concentration really didn't predict cardiovascular events. However, the ability of the HDL to move cholesterol from the plaque out of the bloodstream into the liver did predict. And by the way, when the HDL level was correlated with all the routine things, but the HDL transport function was not. It appears to be independent of other risk factors.
All right, so for the nerds among us, and I would number myself in that group, this is all really very interesting, but how is this going to translate into something that has clinical utility?
Okay, Elizabeth, so let's say we're trying to assess your cardiovascular risk, and we measure your blood pressure and whether you have diabetes, your glucose, and maybe at the end of the day, I'm not measuring your HDL cholesterol, but your ability to transport cholesterol from the plaque into the bloodstream. And if I can do that easily and cheaply, this can be a significant marker of what your risk is for cardiovascular disease. It could possibly replace the measurement of HDL cholesterol totally. What we've done is we've tried to target therapies to increase HDL levels, and those therapies haven't been effective. Maybe we're targeting the wrong thing.
So your prediction then with regard to this being translated into an easily available and inexpensive test is?
I think it's actually very good. There's still some tweaks that need to be done, but I think it's a new biomarker and may give us insight into the function of HDL cholesterol and how we can target therapies. I like it.
Okay, and we're going to stop with that one right now, and time will tell whether we see more of it. Finally, let's turn to this issue again in the New England Journal of Medicine of after you've had a stent placed, how long do you have to stay on those drugs?
And you mentioned drugs because people are put on usually two antiplatelet agents, aspirin, and aspirin's usually continued lifelong, and then a second drug called a thionopyridine, clopidogrel will be one or prasugrel will be one, and we usually continue those for 6 to 12 months. And then after the stent is covered with tissue that grows over it, maybe we can stop the thionopyridine because we'd like to be on fewer drugs, and we also know that the more antiplatelet agents one is on, the higher the risk of bleeding. So the real question is, do you stop at 6 to 12 months or should you continue it longer? This is a study, almost 10,000 patients. All of them received dual antiplatelet therapy, two agents, for up to 1 year. And then they got randomized to either continue with both or continue with aspirin and a placebo. And they followed them for an extra 12 to 30 months. And what they discovered was if you took two therapies for longer, it lowered your risk of having cardiovascular events from about 6% to about 4.5%. It didn't really affect death. It didn't really affect stroke. The trade-off is it was associated with increased bleeding, about 1.6% to 2.5%. By the way, that's moderate or severe bleeding. So there's a trade-off.
Based on this information, what are you going to do in your practice with people who fall into this group?
I was afraid you're going to pin me to the wall on this one, Leslie. I think the therapy needs to be individualized. The higher you feel that the person's risk is of having a heart attack, the more benefit they are to receive from having two antiplatelet agents.
Okay. On that note, then, I'll reveal that I'm going to do the mechanical versus the manual CPR in the blog this week.
And by the way, the editorial has a good picture of the CPR device, so let's include that.
Okay. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.